This is Friday, June 14, 2024. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan, and we are privileged to have with us today Joe Okari. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
May I ask when you were born?
June of 1959.
And where were you born?
In Brighton, Massachusetts, St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
And what community do you currently live in?
My wife and I live in Natick.
And you are married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have two adult sons.
And any grandchildren?
Yes, we have four grandchildren.
Excellent. So I understand you spent a good part of your childhood in Brighton. What was that like?
Well, it was. I lived in the Oak Square neighborhood. It was very nice growing up there. A lot of young families. We all played together in the street. We would be gone basically the whole day till our mothers would start yelling from the front porch, time to come home for dinner, and we'd all run home. But it was great. My father was a Boston police officer, so he was working a lot. He had a couple of different jobs, and we really enjoyed, my sisters and I enjoyed our childhood there.
And I understand when you were about 12, 13, your family moved to Florida.
Yes.
And what was that like?
It was a shock. We moved because my dad was injured on the job and had to retire. So we moved to Florida for a business opportunity for my parents, and I ended up going to high school there. And like I said, I'm at heart a New Englander. I love the change of seasons. And so moving to South Florida with no seasons and 80 degree and sunshine on Christmas Day was a shock to me.
So where and when did you enter the military?
It was 2 months after my 18th birthday in Miami, Florida. I enlisted in the Navy.
And why the Navy?
Family history mostly. I had four maternal uncles who served in the U.S. Navy during World War II. My father served in the Army Air Force in World War II. But my four uncles, one of them was killed in action in the Sea of Japan in 1945, about 2 months before the war ended. He was on a destroyer escort that was hit by a suicide plane. He died at the age of 22. So growing up, I heard stories about my uncles, became family history, and I knew from a very, very young age that I was going to join the Navy. And as soon as I could, I did.
Now, Joe, you joined the Navy at a sort of an interesting time. It was just after Vietnam, and at the time, a lot of people I know were treating the Vietnam War like the 800-pound gorilla in the room. How do you feel about joining the Navy at that time?
That's a great point. It was a very unusual time in our history, and plus in the military history. I love today because I see the young men and women who serve in the military are treated with respect. Post-Vietnam, being in the military was not a popular endeavor. So I was committed to do it. I wanted to do it for personal reasons. And it was tough at times because when we'd go to different ports or different cities in the United States, we weren't well-liked, I think. And it was clear that we were in the military because we all had short hair. So there was no hiding it.
So you enlisted shortly after your 18th birthday. Where were you sent for basic?
Orlando, Florida.
And what was that like?
It was a shock to the system. It was obviously tremendous discipline, rigidity, structure. It was difficult at times, but I liked the fact that it was a challenge and something that I hadn't faced before in my life, anything like that. So to overcome that and survive that was, I felt, a sense of accomplishment, I think.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in basic?
For 8 weeks.
And what happened afterward?
So after that, I was sent to my A school, my technical school, which was in Great Lake, Illinois.
Back to the snow?
Just in time for the winter. We got there in October. And it's the first time I had seen snow since I left Massachusetts. So I was very much excited about that.
So what kind of training did you get at that school?
The school was Operation Specialist School, so it was 14 weeks of various types of shipboard activity training. So we were responsible, we used to call it radar men. We were responsible for the ship's weapon systems, the ship's electronic navigation systems. We would sit in a very dark air-conditioned room behind the bridge called the Combat Information Center, and we would monitor targets, other ships, etc., you know, looking for potential threats to the ship.
Joe, and how long did that training take?
That was four months.
Mm-hmm. And what happened after that?
After that, I was assigned to my first duty station, which was Naval Air Station Key West, Florida.
And what was your rate at the time?
I was an E2 at the time, became an E3 very soon after I arrived in Key West.
And describe some of the duties you have while you were at the station.
So the duties in Key West were the shore-based type of operation specialist duties. So on ship, I described monitoring other targets. In Naval Air Station Key West, I was attached to a fighter squadron called VF-171. And what we did is we sat in a radar site and we worked with pilots who were simulating air-to-air combat. So they would take off in a group of bogeys and aggressors, and our job was to monitor them, give them directions to the enemy, keep them, make sure they're in the airspace, the proper airspace, and help them land the planes or guidance back to the base when they were done. So we basically monitored their combat training.
Okay. And of course, I know Key West sounds like a really nice place, but you're practically in Cuba's back door.
Exactly right.
And,
yes.
And of course, at that time, there's a little bit of tension there between the United States and Cuba.
Yes, and what we did is on our scopes, we actually drew in grease pencil a diagram of the airspace that the pilots were supposed to stay within, because west of that was called the ADIZ, the Air Defense Intercept Zone, and if the pilots strayed over there, they might be intercepted by actual Cuban MiGs. So we were very cognizant of where the pilots were, making sure that A, they didn't go west, and B, no one came into our airspace that wasn't supposed to be there. So a couple of times we had to scramble because we had unidentified aircraft coming through our airspace. So we had to scramble the F-16s from Homestead Air Base.
Okay, Joe, and how long were you stationed at Key West?
That was 18 months.
And aside from being involved in a couple of scrambles, what else do you remember about that period?
Well, it was what I remember being is spending a lot of time at the beach and hanging around Duval Street in Key West. So it wasn't exactly stressful duty. It was pretty easy duty. We worked about 35 hours a week. We had our barracks were right on the beach in near downtown Key West. So I have no complaints about that. There was no war going on at the time, so it was peacetime, and it was pretty relaxed duty, I would say.
Okay, it's 18 months later. Looks like you had a great time down to Key West.
Yes.
Tell us what happened next.
Well, the Navy agreed, and I had a great time at Key West, and they said it's time to go to a ship, which is what you're supposed to do in the Navy. So first was about a 8-week course in Dam Neck, Virginia, to learn naval tactical data systems, and then from there I went to the fleet.
And which fleet would that be?
So I was part of the Atlantic Fleet based out of Charleston Naval Base. My ship was the USS Dewey, which was a guided missile destroyer. And at the time I joined the ship, it was already halfway through a cruise called UNITAS 20, which circumnavigated South America, shot over to West Africa, back to South America, and then up through the Caribbean. So I got there 3 months in, so I met the ship in Santiago, near Santiago, Chile.
You're now on board the USS Dewey?
Yes.
What were your duties?
Well, as an E3, when you get to a new duty station, the first 3 months you spend doing what the Army would call KP. So I worked in the ship's galley for 3 months. And then ultimately went to my original, what I was supposed to be doing in the Navy, which is an operations specialist on the ship. So I by the time we got back to Charleston at the end of the cruise, I was just finishing my galley duty, and the ship went into dry dock in Charleston. So I spent the next year plus assigned to the ship, but we were basically working on rehabbing the ship and upgrading everything.
How'd you like your time in the galley?
That was intense. I forever have had a sense of, well, I don't want to, work in a kitchen since then. That ruined it for me. But it was tough because the crew has to be fed from 5 o'clock in the morning until midnight. So very long hours, 7 days a week.
Right. Time you're in dry dock in South Carolina, so I'm figuring about 2 years into your enlistment?
Yeah, that's about right, yes.
So that's about 1980?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. 80 was the year we were there, 80 through the beginning of 81.
Mm-hmm. And in your own words, it's again another transition time. Reagan's about to be elected. We've got Russians invading Afghanistan. A few words about that period.
It was interesting. In the cruise that we were on, we were in a small task force. It was us, we were a guided missile destroyer. There were two frigates, and there was a submarine with us. So we were on this cruise mainly to show goodwill, also to train and operate with the various navies in South America and West Africa so we could, they were our allies and we wanted to train with them. So at the time we were off the coast of Africa, the Iranian embassy was seized. And there was talk of us diverting to that area to provide support and possibly, defense. But we had an admiral on our ship. We were the admiral's flagship for this exercise. So I think he used his weight to override that, and they sent another task force, and we continued our mission, which was an important mission. So we continued that, and we didn't get diverted to the Persian Gulf. But we were watching that as it was unfolding.
Joined the Navy and you saw the world.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so what happened after you finished dry docking in South Carolina? Tell us what happened next.
So what happens after you leave dry dock is you go through a period of, they call it refresher training. They call it ref training in the Navy. And that's done in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So we sailed to Guantanamo Bay. And that's considered some of the toughest duty in the Navy because you're there to get the ship back up to fighting speed. And you have all these new systems and you have to test them. So that, what that means is every day the ship leaves port at 5 a.m. We're out there doing exercises all day long. We get back around 7 p.m. And that's 6 days a week. So they were very, very long days for a period of 3 months. And there's no liberty, there's no time off, there's nothing to do in Guantanamo Bay anyways, so there's not a whole lot that you're missing, but it was a lot of work and very, very serious work because after that we're going to be heading back to the fleet.
And how long did this take?
The refresher training I think was about 6 months, but 3 months into it my enlistment ended. And they flew me back to Charleston.
And you chose not to re-up?
I chose not to re-up. I had made up my mind that I was going to do this for 4 years, mm-hmm. and then hopefully go to college, because I was 4 years behind everybody else that went to college. So I really wanted to get that part done too. And then if I decided later on I can re-enlist with a college degree and go back as an officer. That was a possibility, but that never happened.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna pause just a second and just talk about some of the technical aspects of your station. I mean, these days it's everything's digital, everything's computerized. What were some of the systems you were operating on? I know we're not talking tubes or hand switches or anything like that, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I know that is also going through a transition period. How about a few words?
Well, I think the military was always ahead of its time when it comes to technology. So we had computer systems. The naval tactical data system we used, the scopes we used were computerized, and they would resemble video games today. So they were way ahead of their time. But we did have, there were manual tasks, like what we had something called a dead reckoning tracer, which was a giant table where you would mechanically plot ships with a pencil and a ruler, and you would plot their courses, and you would determine the closest point of approach. That was done manually, but everything else was electronic, and it was on electronic equipment, scopes, and all the weapon systems were computerized. So amazing for 1980. How much technology did exist.
So let's get you back on the track to civilian life. Where'd you go to school?
College, well, when I left the Navy, I spent a year in Boston.
Okay.
Working for John Hancock as an analyst without a college degree. So again, wanted to go to college. So did that for a while and then said, yep, it's time to do the 4 years, so I went to Florida State University for a year, and then moved back home to Miami area and went to Florida International University and finished my bachelor's degree.
What'd you major in?
Business and marketing.
And where'd you work?
Well, when I got out of college, I got a job with SunTrust Savings Bank in Miami, so I was doing commercial banking for a while. And this is back during the days of the RTC, so SunTrust was one of the banks that failed. So the RTC came in one day and took over. So next thing I know, I was working for the government again.
Regulatory.
Yeah, Resolution Trust Corporation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That must have been scary.
It was scary at first, but it ended up being very helpful to my career. I actually enjoyed working for the RTC, did that for a while, and then that segued into a permanent job that I held for almost 30 years.
And that job?
I worked for a finance company, it was a special servicer, so we did commercial loan servicing mm-hmm. called L&R Partners out of Miami. I worked there for, like I said, 30 years until 2000. Part of the time I was working here in Boston. I had my own office here in Boston. So that's where I left L&R was in Boston, Massachusetts.
Now, out of your naval career, did you receive any commendations?
I received a good conduct medal. That was it.
And did you join any service organizations like the Legion or VFW?
No, I didn't.
And you said you had two adult sons. Did either of them go into the military?
No, they didn't. I didn't encourage it or discourage it. Mm-hmm. One of them at the time was looking at West Point as a possibility, but neither of them chose that career path.
So, Joe, what are you doing these days?
I'm sort of semi-retired. I have my own business I started, a consulting business. I have to say, things are slow right now, but I'm just enjoying, you know, spending time with the grandkids and doing what I want to do each day and not what somebody else tells me I have to do. So
Joe, how important was it for you to serve in the military?
It was very important to me. I mentioned my family history, and I think the fact that my mother lost her brother at age 22, that sort of made me feel like I had to take over for him. And I felt a sense of, I guess, patriotism, you'd call it, and sense of duty to follow in his footsteps. So from a very young age, I always wanted to join the military, and specifically the Navy.
The Do you have any memorable incidents or characters from your naval days that you'd like to record?
Yeah, I would say for a character, my company commander in basic training was a man who really changed a lot of our lives. He was a decent man. He was tough, but he was fair. And a lot of people in the beginning days of basic training were having difficulty physically, emotionally, and he was a senior person and he had pull. So he said, look, if any of you really can't handle this, I can get you out. You'll have a general discharge if it's that tough for you. Because people were like, there were people who were not doing well. But he said, I want to tell you something, that if you quit this, you'll quit other things in your life. And that stuck with me my whole life, that you have to persevere, and even when things get tough. Because I thought about it for a minute. Do I want out? Do I want to go back to my high school friends, you know? But when he said that, I said, he's right, that, you know, once you start going down that path of quitting everything, it doesn't stop. So I stayed.
And Joe, is there anything else before we wrap this up? Wrap up this interview.
Yes, I would say that I want to thank you, because this is a very important thing you're doing here. And we have a generation we call the greatest generation. They're my father's generation, your father's generation. They're disappearing, and they're a national treasure. And the fact that you do this and record their stories and their experiences, this is history. And if we don't record it, we lose it. So I thank you for taking down their stories so that we have them forever, because that we'll never see another generation like that. And I'm thankful to have known members of the generation.
And so with that, Joe Porcari, we thank you for taking part in the Native Veterans Oral History Project.
Thank you.